Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amber Nickel, the host of the channel, and today we are going to be talking with Yekiel Weitzman about his recent publication, Unsettled Heritage, Living Next to Poland's Material Jewish Traces After the Holocaust, which came out this year on Cornell University Press. He is currently a lecturer at the Israel and Golda Koshitsky Department of Jewish History and Contemporary Jewry at Bar Ilan University in Israel. He also is a well-known author who has published on topics like this extensively. Yechiel, welcome to the channel. I am really excited to discuss this text with you here today.
Thank you, Amber. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here and to discuss the book with you.
You open your text with the story of your travel to a provincial Polish town in 2016. Would you mind briefly sharing this trip with listeners, using it to explain what led you to research and write Unsettled Heritage?
Yes, of course. So it was Sunday afternoon. I was visiting the town of Korbuszowa in southern eastern Poland, looking for the Jewish cemetery as part of my research. And I was asking around the people if they know where the Jewish cemetery is. I knew that it's located somewhere in the outskirts of town, in a forest, but it was hard to reach. People directed me to the general direction, but I was lost. So I found myself in a convenience store, asking the owner if he knows where is the Jewish cemetery. And suddenly one of the customers who was just buying a bottle of beer turned around and said, I know where the Jewish cemetery is. Come, I will take you. Now, this man was, he was obviously drunk, and it seemed that he has been like this for some time. He wore shabby clothes, and but he looked very nice. So I said, okay, I will go with you. And so we walked for 20 minutes. It wasn't easy to understand him. He was a bit confused. And I have to say, it was very weird encounter walking with him to the end of town into the forest, but apparently he knew exactly where to go. There was no signs, but he knew perfectly well the road, and he took me directly to the entrance of the Jewish cemetery, and he also insisted on going in with me. So we entered the cemetery, and like many Jewish cemeteries around Poland and Eastern Europe, the place was covered with bushes and grass. Some of the headstones, the matzevot, were broken or bent. And he, my companion, was obviously very moved, and he murmured in Polish all the time, bez szacunku, bez szacunku, meaning no respect, no respect. And he started telling me that the story of the Jewish community, and he knew a lot. And then he told me, I want to show you another thing. And he took me inside the forest to this deserted cemetery. Then I saw some sort of memorial built in the 50s for the in honor of several hundreds of Jews that were murdered there inside the cemetery and were buried in mass graves. And he stood there and told me the entire story. And then he told me I was born 15 years after the massacre. So this encounter was really interesting, bizarre, moving, exciting, and it was part of one of many experiences that I had trying to understand this unique and special power and ambience of abandoned Jewish sites in the Polish provinces. And these kinds of encounters led me to wonder how these sites acquired this very special and unique place in the local memory, in the local conscious, what happened to them after the war, or mainly who decided on their future, how they were perceived and interacted with during the communist years, and what were the factors that determined their status, both the actual status and also their symbolic status, and why some survived and others didn't. So these questions basically took me to a very long journey, both intellectual, emotional, and also physical. I spent a lot of time in local archives, interviewing people in several towns. And the result of this research is basically the book.
In your first chapter, you address the material traces of Jewish culture and Jewish returns in the late stages of World War II and the immediate post-war. Can you share with listeners today a little bit about what post-war Jewish life looked like in Poland?
So although the war was over, Poland in the immediate post-war period was still a very dangerous and unstable place, not only for the returning Jews, but in general. There was a general political and social chaos. Some sort of civil war was basically taking place between the supporters of the communists, who were gradually taking hold of the country, and the nationalist circles and groups of bandits, partisans, and displaced persons were moving around the countryside amid an atmosphere of material destruction, shortages of housing and basic infrastructure. And Jews in this chaotic situation were in many ways the most vulnerable population. We know that according to recent research, between 1,000, some say even 2,000 Jews were killed and murdered after the war between 1944 to 1947 from various purposes. Many of these violent incidents were connected to questions of property, when Jews were trying to reclaim back their private property and encountered resistance. Jews were also identified as taking the side of the new communist rule, reinvigorating the myth of the Jido Comuna, Judeo-Communism. So, and this identification jeopardized them. And it took it took several years until the situation somehow calmed. And amid this atmosphere of instability and lack of security, Jews did return to life. And they could establish some of the communal infrastructure. They were able to have a political autonomy. Cultural and social institutions were reactivating. Sometimes we tend to forget, but until the summer of 1946, until the Kielce pogrom, almost 250,000 Jews still lived in Poland. And people still hoped and believed that there will be some sort of future to the largest Jewish community in Europe. Also in the west of Poland, in the areas that were incorporated to Poland on the expense of Germany, Jews were building new settlements. And it seemed that in these areas, there is a real possibility to somehow renew Jewish life. These hopes, in many ways, ended towards the end of the 1940s, with the beginning of the Stalinist rule. Many Jews, thousands of Jews, were emigrating out of the country. But still, throughout the communist years and the subsequent wave of emigration, there was some Jewish presence and Jewish leaders were trying, at least, among other things, to take care of their material Jewish heritage. And this is also a central part of my book.
So how did the remnants of Jewish material culture, coupled with the catastrophic demographic losses due to the Holocaust, as well as flight in the wake of events like the Kielce pogrom, factor into discussions about Jewishness, Jewish spaces, and Jewish property in post-war Poland?
Mm-hmm. So although Jewish congregations still existed mainly in the larger cities, most of Poland's former small towns, the Shtetlach, had become or soon became completely emptied of Jewish presence. And I think that this striking gap between a pre-war very rooted Jewish presence and post-war near total Jewish absence from the communal fabric was emphasized by the persistence of what in many of these towns now became the last remaining traces of Jewish life, namely abandoned cemeteries and empty synagogues. And so local authorities and citizens in these towns that prior to the war, many of these towns used to be heavily populated with Jews. So the remaining Polish population were faced with the question, what to do with these thousands of empty, deserted spaces? Now, it was obvious that they will not be used for ritual purposes because Jewish congregation will not be active there. And during the rebuilding momentum after the war, this question became all the more pressing. And throughout the post-war years, there was a general understanding and also a legitimation that these sites should be repurposed for local needs, or sometimes erased, demolished, or built over. And the repeating argument among local officials who constantly ask the government for approval to use, to repurpose, or to destroy an abandoned Jewish site was, there are no more Jews here. Sometimes some even mentioned that there is not even one single Jew in our town. Therefore, it is only legitimate that we, the town, will make use of the Jewish communal sites. But I think that precisely this striking gap between presence and absence seemed to have only charged these sites with multiple symbolic meanings and emotional layers, as they became now really the only reminders and remainders of the murdered Jews. So for Polish Jews, those who still remained in Poland, trying to protect and preserve the last vestiges of Jewish culture in the former shtetls became now really a sacred duty and a moral obligation, even when it was clear that these sites will not be used. And also for the local Polish communities and local authorities, I think that the existence of these dilapidated Jewish spaces as the only trace of Jewish presence seem to have emphasized and magnified the emptiness the sites radiated. And in many ways, as I show in the book, Jewish cemeteries and synagogues were projected with the perceptions, memories, and stereotypes that in the past were ascribed to the living Jews. So in a sense, the Jewish space replaced the Jews. They took the space took the place of the Jews in the new post-war local folklore. And in a sense, through the post-war interaction of Poles with the material remnants of the Jews and through the discussion on the future, they were in essence, I believe, maintaining an ambivalent interaction with the Jews as figures of memory. And I would say that this very unique perception and status that was acquired by the Jewish space made it also difficult for Polish authorities to discuss in a dispassionate and rational way and really complicated the attempts to settle their status. So in one of the chapters, I discuss a very interesting phenomenon that took place in the first post-war year when a lot of local authorities were asking for permission to use Jewish sites, mainly synagogues. And although the sites were empty and there were no Jews around, still many of those local officials found it very hard to assimilate the notion that the Jews are no longer owners of the communal property, because according to the new law, in fact, Jewish communities had no ownership right on their former communal properties. But still, it seems that it took several years for local officials to come to terms with this notion. So we can see how they still contacted Jewish representatives, asking them to sell them their communal sites, although they couldn't do so, the Jews, because it didn't belong to them anymore. So what I'm trying to make of this phenomenon is some sort of interesting, I would say, inability among the local level of the Polish governance to really understand that the Jewish story is over and done with. And this, I think, has to do with this very present emptiness, I would say some sort of deceptive emptiness that became the reality in many of these small towns.
So how did political developments in Poland really start to shift some of these initial discussions and interactions? Say, for example, during the so-called Polish Thaw, or even in the post-socialist period?
So the changing political realities in Poland's communist and post-communist years indeed shaped the interplay, I would say, between the state authorities, municipal officials, the local population, and Jewish leaders concerning the Jewish issue, the treatment of the Jewish minority, and also the status and fate of Jewish sites. So, for example, while until the late 1940s, state officials showed some level of protection to Jewish sites and local leaders were still somewhat hesitant to appropriate and use them for local purposes, already in the early 50s, and especially after the Polish Thaw in 1956, it became much more easier to use Jewish space for everyday needs or even to destroy them altogether. Also, another reason was that after 1956, there was a huge wave of immigration of Jews, and it also made it difficult for Jewish leaders to protect their religious sites in the provinces. And also, in the increasingly nationalist and anti-Semitic atmosphere in the late 50s and in the 60s, the regime was now more willing to approve local requests to clear away cemeteries and synagogues. And the municipal authorities on their part felt much more confident and eager to erase signs of Jewish culture from the local landscape. But we can also see how the certain liberalization and pluralization of the cultural sphere in Poland after 1956 have also enabled the first opportunities for a grassroots engagement with abandoned Jewish sites, initiated by local activists, local Polish activists and artists, who, in a way, were trying to protest against the widespread profanation and vandalization of the religious spaces. And these, I would say, emerging sensibilities also strengthened following the aftermath of the anti-Zionist campaign in 1968, which, as we know, culminated in the expulsion of thousands of Jews from Poland. And coming to terms with this wave of anti-Semitism has encouraged growing circles of intellectual and social activists and ordinary citizens to really rediscover the material Jewish heritage and also to fight for its survival as some sort of a counter-reaction to the violence. And at the same time, the regime, the Polish regime, believed that facing the international criticism over what happened in 1968, supporting projects of material reconstruction of well-known Jewish sites might actually ease some of the international scrutiny. And also, as we enter the post-socialist era, with all of its complexities, we see how preserving Jewish cemeteries and renovating synagogues became a really substantial and overwhelming cultural phenomenon involving many stakeholders and actors, both from Poland and abroad, who are motivated from very different and even conflicting concerns. And we can even see today, in light of the recent very heated and emotional debates in Poland concerning the history and the memory of the Holocaust and Polish-Jewish relations during the war, question of Jewish property, how, in a way, these debates are being refracted in the perception and treatment of Jewish sites. So this is a very interesting development that we can observe in recent years and even months.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think, as is already coming out in our discussion, it's evident that throughout your text, you underscore the tensions between the desire to remember and the desire to forget, to demolish and to preserve. How might listeners and readers make sense of this tension, if any sense can be made?
Yes, I think this is a very interesting question, which really touches the crux of the book. I think that the interaction of the Polish society with the presence of the material Jewish leftovers evoked and continue to evoke, as we see, a very wide spectrum of attitudes, practices, and emotions. Among them, seemingly conflicting reactions and tendencies, such as remembering and forgetting, and also demolishing and preserving. And in many ways, they often, all of these attitudes and reaction often commingle together. And I think this commingling of very conflicting reaction testifies to the very ambivalent nature of Jewish sites after the Holocaust. And more broadly, I would say to the ambivalent place of the Jews in the post-war Polish consciousness. And perhaps a way to make sense of it is to understand the role of Jewish sites in the post-Holocaust landscape as what I define in the book as metonyms. Metonyms not only of the Jews, but also of their wartime fate. And in fact, many Jewish cemeteries in small towns were indeed killing sites and places of mass burial during the Holocaust. So they really became identified with the murder of the Jews in the most concrete sense. So as such, as places that were identified with the Holocaust, these sites evoked conflicting reactions. So on the one hand, as long as they remained in the heart of town or repressed behind the bushes at the outskirts of town, these sites inevitably threatened to crack the, I would say, the post-war status quo, which was tacitly agreed by the communist authorities and by the society. And basically, this status quo was founded on a collective forgetting of the Holocaust. Because discussing the Holocaust, discussing what happened to the Jews, could raise very uncomfortable issues, such as the involvement of parts of the society in the persecution of Jews, or in the taking of their property, and other such episodes that, according to recent historical research, we know that happened. But this attempt at forgetting what happened to the Jews was an active attempt and a recurring one. And in this sense, the drive toward demolition and erasure of Jewish spaces, which was, by the way, pushed and justified mainly by the local authorities, was part of an obsessive attempt to clear the local landscape, as I analyze it, to clear the landscape from any mnemonic traces of the wartime Jewish fate. And also we can see how phenomena such as littering Jewish burial grounds or bringing animals to pasture in deserted cemeteries, these practices were more than just simple ignorance or disdain or lack of awareness, but rather, as I call it, negative memorial practices, which paradoxically show how the active act of forgetting is, in a way, testifying on the really strong mnemonic presence of the Jewish past. And at the same time, the identification of the Jewish sites with the fate of the Jews was precisely what triggered local attempts to rescue these places, to protest the desecration and to stop the authorities from repurposing them. We can read, for example, I bring it in the book, many letters, protest letters sent by Polish citizens to the authorities or to media organs, in which they tried to protest against what's happening, against the gradual destruction of Jewish sites in their hometowns. And it's obvious that what motivated these individuals was first and foremost the outrage from the desecration of the memory of the Holocaust. So the identification of the murder of the Jews really was the element that that made these places, I would say, in different ways, so charged and harboring very different and conflicting emotional responses.
As a whole, your book really is a case study of how societies have lived next to and continue to live next to the material traces of a troubled past and make sense of remnants of absent and exiled minorities. To what extent do the insights of your book hold relevance for other post-conflict, post-genocide societies around the world?
So during the work on the book, I started to realize that in many ways there are a lot of similar patterns, I would say almost universal patterns, that that govern the way in which deserted religious sites or abandoned property are being perceived and treated and interacted with among local communities in contested societies or post-conflict situation. And both in the discursive and also practical level, we can see how these objects and sites that often belong to previous minorities are continuing to evoke antagonism and also to encourage the desire to destroy them or to appropriate them. But at the same time, we can see how these sites also radiate a very complex array of ambivalences that I could find both in the Polish-Jewish case, but in other places. So, for example, I started reading about Cyprus. So, in 1974, after the Turkish invasion to the northern part of the island, there was a population exchange. So, Cypriot Turks moved to the north, while Greek Cypriots had to emigrate and leave the north of the island, leaving behind houses and lands and objects. And there were very interesting research made in trying to understand what happened to the abandoned property and site left by the Greeks in the northern part of the island. How did the new Turkish settlers who entered empty houses and used property of Greeks who recently fled, how they treated this property? And in many ways, we can see that for a lot of them, it wasn't easy to really appropriate and to really to make these new acquired spaces and objects their own. There was a strong level of, I would say, hesitance or even apprehension from really being able to use Greek object. And I could see it also in my case. We can see that in many towns, although a lot of sites were erased and other buildings were erected there, usually it was the case, but in a lot of places, we can also detect a certain level of apprehension from using an emptied Jewish space for other purposes. So even, for example, when a synagogue was demolished by a town, in several cases, the site of the former synagogue remained empty. And nothing was ever built there. And while talking to people and trying to figure out why, you can see in many different Polish towns empty Jewish spaces where the cemetery once stood or where the synagogue once stood, you can detect this, I would say, this certain level of unease or even embarrassment from building over a former religious site. In another example, I also encountered where I myself live in Israel, a place that also has its fair share of abandoned and deserted sites of other minorities. And while trying to understand what happened, for example, to abandoned Muslim cemeteries, you can also detect similar patterns of behaviors and attitudes that I could see in the Polish case concerning Jewish sites, also in a way here in Israel. So it made me realize that we are dealing here, of course, with a very concrete story, but in many ways we can learn, I think, something very interesting about how does a society live next to the material traces of another society, of another minority that once shared the same landscape, and in to what extent this experience of living next to the physical traces of others is not a simple experience, and it's much more ambivalent and complex, I would say, than what we normally think.
We have taken up quite a bit of your time today. I want to wrap up our interview with my traditional question on New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
Yes, so now I'm working on a new project, which is a microhistorical research focusing on one town in Poland, Olkusz. It appeared, this town, in the book, and I decided to zoom in on this particular town and to examine the Polish-Jewish interaction and the question of the transformation of Jewish spaces. But I'm stretching the time frame. So I'm looking on the period since the beginning of the 20th century until today, trying to understand through the transformation of Jewish sites, objects, and spaces, the Polish-Jewish encounter. So I'm looking now not only on the question of religious spaces, but also on the question of private property. For example, what was the status of private Jewish property and Jewish object, both before the war, during the Holocaust, and also after the war? And it raises, I think, very interesting questions concerning inter-ethnic relations, material culture. And I think basically it allows me to look at things from a very from a much broader perspective. So focusing not only on the post-war period, which I did, as I did in the book, but also going back. And I think this is a very interesting experience to me. And it also raises some questions and reflections about the book, I have to say.
Thanks for sharing that with us. I'm looking forward to reading that one. I have no doubt it's going to be just as amazing as this one. For the listeners out there, if today's discussion piqued your interest, you can pick up a copy of Yechiel Weitzman's Unsettled Heritage, Living Next to Poland's Material Jewish Traces After the Holocaust, directly from Cornell University Press, or you can always order it from your local bookstore.